Thank you again, Dave. We appreciate it. Always good selections. That was a good one. Fits very well for tonight for a couple of reasons. So we appreciate it. All right. Let's see. If you turn in your Bibles, turn to 2 Chronicles 14. 2 Chronicles 14, and we'll be looking at verses 8 through 15. So 2 Chronicles 14, 8 through 15. And this is the second study on the life of King Asa. And I titled it, if you were here last week or not, or Sunday morning, Relying on the Lord. I'm going to, if you don't have the handout, it's not a big deal, but I will review it one more time this evening before we look at the actual verses. But I'm sure we're probably all familiar with the term underdog. That's someone who has a little chance of victory or overcoming opposition. There's a lot of examples of that as far as sports go. You know, you have somebody who's an underdog and you go into a game or whatever the scenario is and they end up prevailing and everybody sort of cheers for the underdog. Well, sometimes they do. Hopefully there's no Boston Red Sox fans, but I found out that, do you know how many years they had to wait to win the World Series? 86. And even when they did, they had to overcome and go against all the odds. But I say that just for you to think. It's not that uncommon. You actually find this idea a lot in the Bible, as we'll look at tonight and such. But Asa tonight is going to encounter a situation. It's early in his time, early relative to how long he was a king. And the situation seems hopeless. But what I want you to focus on, because this sort of tails into, and I'll repeat this in a few minutes, it tails into the end of his life. So we're in the earlier portion of his life, roughly. And I want us to look at where does he turn when this opposition comes. Because at the end of his life, there's another situation and he's going to turn somewhere else. Does that make sense? It's almost like the bookend I told you. If you like to take notes or kind of have an idea of where we're going, I'm going to review the handout one more time. But in terms of the text, verses 8 through 10, we'll look at that. That's Asa's overwhelming opposition. So that's verses 8 through 10 of chapter 14. And then we're going to see Asa's prayer in verse 11. And it's really short. Did you know you don't have to pray very long for the Lord to hear you and him to answer? So we'll see that tonight. I know everybody's getting a little snicker here, but just poking a little fun. But and then in verses 12 through 15, the Lord answers Asa's prayer. It's a simple layout. It's a simple structure. But it is helpful for later on in his life. And again, so 8 through 10, Asa's overwhelming opposition. And then in verse 11, Asa's prayer. And then the Lord's going to answer Asa's prayer in verses 12 through 15. Let's do a review before we look at those verses in case you just need to refresh yourself. If you look at the handout, a little different than like what we did for the first missionary journey. But what I want you to do is just to have in your mind sort of the setting of it. And it's just a refresher. Probably know most of this already. One of the easy ways to sort of see where the Old Testament is going, because the books are not just independent. They're not these little stories and they don't have any connection. It's all one book, all one story, that sort of thing. An easy way in regards to how we end up with Kings is what I have here. If you start in Genesis 12, that's the Abrahamic covenant, where Abraham is promised, of course, that he would make a great, through him would be a great nation, and many would be blessed and so forth. Of course, at that time, there's not a nation like what we will see in just a few minutes. But at the end of Genesis, if you remember, just following the handout, at the end of Genesis, he's got a large group of people. They're down in Egypt, and God is going to deliver them, bring them up out of Egypt. So in Exodus through Deuteronomy, you have the people taking a long time to get nowhere, don't they? They spend a long time, but they eventually get to the promised land. Moses, though, is not the one who brings them in, does he? He brings them to the edge. But then if you look next in Joshua through Judges, the reason why I have those together is Joshua gets them in the land. the nation has to have a land, doesn't it? I mean, a nation isn't a nation without land. He brings them in the land, they get settled in the land, and then in Judges, what is it? There was no king, right? They had the 12 tribes. So they're still not quite where we're at, where we are at in terms of kings. But if you notice the last bullet there, 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings, this will be sort of how we get to King Asa. And this is an overly simplistic way to think of it. But basically what happens is, of course, the nation wants to have a king, and God gives them the kings. And if you notice in the Roman numeral there, it says United Kingdom. And the monarchy, you could use that phrase, I suppose, if you like. But you see that there's three kings and they're united. In other words, the kingdom is united. You have King Saul, King David, and then Solomon. What happens after Solomon? Yeah, everything falls apart, and then they divide into what we have in Roman numeral 2 and 3. So a lot of times people get confused. You read in the Psalms or maybe Isaiah or whatever the case is, and you hear them say, Judah and Israel, what's the difference? You remember? The northern kingdom is always, if you remember from the map, it's always Israel. The southern kingdom is always Judah. But the thing I want us to remember is, if you look there, they didn't have a lot of good kings, did they? In fact, at the most, between Judah and Israel, meaning the northern and the southern kingdom, you end up with either 39 or 40 kings, depending on if you count Tibni, and no good kings in northern Israel, but seven, as I have them, basically good. And that's probably a better way to say it than just flat good, because even in these ones that are good, they still have shortcomings to them. Now, Asa's story, if you remember on the handout there, is briefly mentioned in 1 Kings. That's why we're using Chronicles. So it's only mentioned there a little bit. So the nation, if you imagine, is divided. They've had two wicked, evil kings who happen to be his grandfather and father. So Asa's coming after not a very good godly line, is he? You remember, we looked at that last time. And so it's a nation that's divided. It's a nation, though, more importantly, that's in spiritual decay, and it's spiraling out of control, and eventually they'll go into captivity. But what I want you to see here before we look at our verses tonight is, if you notice at the end, the theme of Asa is very simple. It's one of the easiest themes to remember with the kings. In the beginning of his life, we saw last week in verses 1 through 7, that what did he do? He sought the Lord. He relied on the Lord. That's where he looked. At the end of his life, he forsook the Lord. He did not rely on him, in other words. And so the question is, how did he get from relying on the Lord to not relying on the Lord? Now, last week we know, again, he becomes king after his father and grandfather. But then in the early part, he relied on the Lord. And what was the fruit or the results of his relying on the Lord? Yeah, right, Sue. So they had peace. The land was at rest. He used the time to build up the nation, to try to restore the nation's spiritual fiber as well. But as we go to read verses 8 through 10, how long does Satan allow good things to happen? Not too long, does he? But sometimes, though, the other side of that is, sometimes I think the Lord allows difficulties or problems or trials to enter into our lives to test us, doesn't he? So sometimes both are true. And tonight I want us to look at this, because he's going to be tested, and he's going to have this opposition that's just, quite frankly, it's overwhelming humanistically speaking. Where does he turn? Because he's going to have a situation later on in his life, and he's going to do the opposite. So it doesn't take long, problems arise, and where is he going to turn? And that's where we find ourselves in verses 8 through 10. So would someone want to read the verses 8 through 10 for me?
Now Asa had an army of 300,000 of Zephathath at Merisha.
Sorry, Dave, I gave you the tongue twisters tonight. And you just got to ride the bike, too, so that was pretty good. Yeah, I was going to say, don't worry, I practiced a few times myself, and I still can't get them right. So it was actually better than I did. But the land was at rest, the nation was at rest. If you remember last week, in verse 1 of 2 Chronicles 14, and it was undisturbed for 10 years, and they went about doing the things that they did. But now opposition comes, and the opposition's pretty great. But notice Asa. So Asa has, of course, this is Judah and Benjamin together, is about, obviously it's over 500, but 580,000, if you will, troops. That's what the army, if you will, is. Remember, during that time of peace, he built up and restored the nation. He built up the military and did those types of typical type things. But here, if you notice, he's got 580 on his side, and he's got all these individuals. They have shields, bows, they have all these really strong warriors. But if you notice when Dave read in verse 9, a little bit of a problem, though, isn't it? How many and what is the opposition of the Ethiopian army? 1 million plus 300 chariots. So you figure you've got a million, plus you've got all these individuals with these chariots. Now imagine being Asa and his army, and he's got a little over 500,000, and then there is this Ethiopian army that has over, of course, has a million men, but plus, right? I mean, because you've got more than that with the chariots. And that's pretty overwhelming, isn't it? And so he's got this great opposition against him, and the odds, of course, are not stacked in his favor. If you're curious, and I didn't use a map for this, but I can give you a rough estimate of where it is. So Maresha is 25 miles south, sort of southwest of Jerusalem. So if you wanted to look in a Bible map, I'm going to try to do this so it's your direction. So if you imagine Jerusalem right here, he's going to go about right here. It's about 25 miles to the southwest, roughly, okay? And you'll see later on how this plays into something near the Gaza Strip. You hear that today, right? So that's sort of the direction we're going, and then later we'll go into that. But all I want you to see here is this is pretty bleak, isn't it? Can you imagine being there, and you've got a million-man army coming up against you, and you have half? And plus they have all these chariots. That's pretty overwhelming, isn't it?
Are they coming from Ethiopia as we know it today?
Yeah.
From Africa?
Yeah. So, I'm trying to do this backwards. So, Charlie, if you imagine Jerusalem here, and you've got Ethiopia probably, yeah, I'm trying to do this backwards.
Isn't that real? This is the same Ethiopia as today in Africa?
Yeah, I mean, same sort of area, yeah. Huh. So imagine them coming up, and they would be coming up past like where the Gaza Strip is today. And you've got these million in the army there with the chariots. So they've gone up there, and then King Asa has the army that comes there. Does that help a little bit? So, yeah. Okay. All right, so where is he going to turn? Where is Asa going to turn for help? The chronicler is putting this here for a particular reason, because at the end, in chapter 16, meaning at the end of Asa's life, the same scenario doesn't come up, but he's going to be asked to turn somewhere and to look somewhere, and he's not going to. Okay, so it's going to be different. But in verse 11, I want someone to read this, because I want you to see where in his early life, in the earlier portion of his, if you will, kingship, where does he turn? This is probably Connie's verse. This is verse 11. Yeah. Connie's already ready to go. All right, Connie, go ahead.
Then Asa called to the Lord his God and said, "Lord, there is no one besides you to help in the battle."
All right, thank you, Connie. So here we have, this is an interesting prayer because it's pretty short, isn't it? There's not a lot of time to pray, is it? If you've got a million individuals looking to kill you plus 300 chariots, time is not allowing for elaborate prayer. Does God always need you to do an elaborate prayer? No. Yes, that's good. Yeah, I had a that's a good one too, because Barrett will know who this is, but there was a minister, actually he's the one who helped me get ordained. He used to say prayer's good in a prayer meeting, but not when you're in a bear meeting. Get it? You meet a bear? Sort of the idea of what Sue was saying. You know, I think we have this idea that God needs this long, elaborate prayer, and there's nothing wrong with that. You have these beautiful, long prayers, but sometimes you got to pray quick, right? And so this is very quick. But notice how beautiful the prayer is. This is such a beautiful prayer here. So let's go through this a little bit. So the first thing you'll see is, of course, where does he turn? And that's really what the chronicler is trying to show you. Where does he turn in the early days of his life? He relied on the Lord. He walked in the ways of David. But here he turns to the Lord, his God, and he calls on Lord. Now, all capital Lord, we remember that's different than the, I say, lowercase version. Do you remember what the difference is? Yep. Yep. Yahweh, I am. You know, I am who I am. So he's calling on the God of all creation, the God of the universe, whatever you want to say. He's calling on him. But you'll notice here, he says, there's no one besides you to help. So he's completely turned to him, isn't it? He doesn't think that a little bit of Asa and a little bit of Asa's army plus a little bit of God will do it. He says, I turn to you and there's no one to help us. There's no one who can help us to do this in battle. And then he says, of course, he's got, obviously there, he's turned to him completely to trust in him. He relies on him. But then he refers to God's power. He says, the powerful of those who have no strength, so help us. There is this word that sometimes describes one of God's attributes. It's called omnipotence, isn't it? What is omnipotence? You know, there's the omnis of God. Omnipotence is that he's all-powerful, okay? But you'll see here that he says that those who have no strength. That's curious, though, isn't it? Because Asa's got a pretty good army. It's not to suggest that he doesn't. He's got over 500,000 individuals. But he sees them powerless against this enemy, and so he's going to trust in the Lord to help him. And so he relies on the Lord, he completely trusts in him, and he also has confidence in the Lord. So help us, for we trust in you. David Jeremiah has a study Bible, and in there it says, 1 million against 500,000 is not a very good ratio. It's not, is it? The rest of his quote says, but the ratio does not count when the Lord is with you. And that's sort of the idea there. The chronicler is trying to show you where Asa has this dependence upon the Lord and such. But it's fascinating. If you notice at the end of the prayer where Connie was reading, I'm just going to repeat it. He says, for we trust in you and in your name have come up against this multitude. O Lord, you are our God. Let not man prevail against whom? Against you. It's interesting because to go up against God's people is to ultimately go up against the Lord, isn't it? Those are God's chosen people. Do they sin? Are they in error? Do they make mistakes? Sure, but they're still his chosen people. And he knows, Asa does, that to go up against his people is to go up against the Lord. And so Asa has, of course, an army, but his army would, of course, not receive the praise and glory, would they? One of the things to remember here is if they are able to overcome it, someone will look and see there's no way they could have overcome it on their own, and it must have been someone who helped, and that someone would be the Lord. I want you to think about something. Asa walked in the ways of whom? Who was he likened to? Do you remember what I told you last time? What is the king? Yeah, the king. Okay. I want you to turn with me to 1 Samuel. Because Asa walked in the ways of David, and David is an example of somebody who had a lot of opposition in his life, and we're going to look at one. It's a familiar one, but I want us to look at this particular verse, though. It's 1 Samuel chapter 17. So 1 Samuel 17, and then in verse 46. But what I want you to think of is, think of what Asa prayed in verse 11, but then we're going to look at what happens here with David in David and Goliath. Now, we know the story, don't we? On paper, is Goliath the underdog or is David the underdog? I've always wondered which. No, I'm just kidding. We obviously know Goliath is the strong one, and not only is he the strong one, David, you wouldn't even think would even be out there. He should have been tending sheep, but he was the brave one and was going to go forward and all those things. But I want someone to read for me verses 46 through 47. And when you read it, think of the similarities to what we saw in the prayer. Would someone want to read those two verses, or I can do it?
46 through
47, I'm sorry.
This day the Lord will deliver you up into birds of the sky and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or by spear. For the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands.
Similar to what we sang earlier, isn't it? This is almost verbatim. So what you see there is that, of course, Asa, he walked and was similar in a lot of ways to David. And, of course, David was the one who went up against Goliath. I always find it just a fascinating story on its own, so I won't drift into that. But it's a lot of similarities, isn't it, in the fact that it is ultimately who that triumphs over Goliath? Well, David, but the power behind David's ability was what? It was God working through him, is another way to say that. Does God work through his weak people in the church? Yeah. For when I am weak, that I am strong for the power of Christ. Right? God hasn't really changed in many of those ways, has he? He still uses weak things to overcome those things, and the Lord will prevail. But let's go back here, because Goliath, of course, didn't fare too well against the Lord, did he? David prevailed, the Lord prevailed, that sort of paradox there. But I want us to look at verses 12 through 15, because the Lord is going to answer that brief prayer of Asa's in a pretty strong way. Does someone want to read those, or else I can read them? It's 12 through 15. All right, I'm going to read them then. I'll see if I can pronounce some of those names. I think Dave may beat me on those, but let me read 12 through 15. So the Lord routed, in Hebrew it means to strike down, if you are curious. So the Lord routed the Ethiopians before Asa and before Judah, and the Ethiopians fled. Asa and the people who were with him pursued them as far as Gerar. That is the place that's a little bit past Gaza. So if you can visualize that today, this is how far down they get pursued and they get driven back. But let me pick up. Verse 13, and so many Ethiopians fell that they could not recover, for they were shattered before the Lord and before his army. And they carried away very much plunder. They destroyed all the cities around Gerar, for the dread of the Lord had fallen on them. And they despoiled all the cities, for there was much plunder in them. They also struck down those who owned livestock, and they carried away large numbers of sheep and camels. Then they returned to Jerusalem. So as we see in verses 12 through 15, the obvious answer is, did the Lord answer the prayer or not? And he did so pretty strong, didn't he? The word there that I read to rout, I told you before, in Hebrew, it literally means to strike or to strike down something. So it's describing that pretty gruesome, isn't it? I mean, you've got this million-plus army in this small army, and this army was completely destroyed. The Lord just wiped them out. And they went down, and they drove them so far. If you notice here, it says that the Ethiopians fled. So if you remember the question that was asked, and try to do this as best I can backwards. So you have Jerusalem, if you imagine here. Originally, they went to battle probably southwest around here. Gaza is about over here. They drove them all the way back. That's amazing, isn't it? Because you've got an army that's twice as big, plus all those chariots, and they drive them there, and they destroy everything. But then you notice this is they destroyed all the cities that were near there. And what else did they do? The cities were taken, the livestock taken. I mean, they didn't leave really much left, did they? You're talking about a striking down, total destruction there. And that was what the power is. But I'll draw your attention to something here. If you notice verse 13, it says they were shattered before the Lord and before whose army? It's the Lord's army. The Lord used, if you will, Asa and the army that Judah had established there. And of course, those were some of the tools by which that he destroyed them. Let me read something to you. I found it helpful. It's by William MacDonald. He has a commentary, it's called the Bible, or Believer's Bible Commentary, and he says, there is no time in battle to be eloquent, but prayers born out of desperate need are very effective if the person praying is in a right relationship with the Lord. But notice the ending here. He says, because Asa followed the Lord in peace, he knew the Lord would care for him in war. That's a good point, isn't it? Do you see what he's trying to say? In the portion of scripture we saw in the beginning, in other words, last week, it was a time of peace, and he trusted in God. God was there with him. But then when the time of difficulty came, of course, he knew where to turn, and the Lord was with him. In other words, what McDonald is saying is, whether it's peace or a difficult time, was the Lord with him in both or just one? He was with him in both. And that's sort of the thing that you need to see there, is that he relied on the Lord. He turned to the Lord. Unfortunately, what's going to happen is at the end of his life, a situation is going to come, and he's going to have been rebuked and told, don't not turn to the Lord. Turn to the Lord. And he's not going to. So somewhere along the way, we're going to have to figure out what made him not rely on the Lord when the Lord delivered him. And it makes for an interesting next few chapters. But let me mention a couple of things, and then I'll give you guys some time. I was trying to, in case you had any questions. But difficult situations should cause us to turn to the Lord and trust in Him totally. Complete dependence on Him. I think sometimes what I have seen, especially as a pastor, is difficult times come along and we seem to not go to Him. Do you understand what I'm saying? Sometimes it's easy to trust in the Lord, depend on Him, rely on Him, but then when things get difficult, what do we want to do? We want to fix the problem ourselves, don't we? When you start to think about it, obviously this is on a much grander scale, but we are very quick to want to fix the problem on ourselves. That's sort of what he begins to get into. He begins to rely on himself more than the Lord. The other is our prayers do not have to be long to be effective, do they? I'm not saying that they can't be, because there's plenty of long prayers. But sometimes what do we need to do? We need to, there's a time to have a long, eloquent, beautiful prayer. But then there's other times we just need to cry out to God and do so quickly. But lastly, the Lord who is with us in the good days is the same one who's with us in the bad, isn't he? Now, next time, now leave some time for comments and questions. If you want to read ahead, you're going to begin to see this poking a little bit. It's verses 1 through 7. There's a prophet. This is a non-writing prophet. When I say non-writing prophet, this wouldn't be like Isaiah, but like an Elijah-type prophet. But it's verses 1 and 7 through chapter 15. The prophet's going to warn Asa about this general subject. He's going to encourage him a little bit, and then you'll begin to see where we end up for too long, where towards the end of Asa's life, he stopped relying on the Lord and he begins to trust in himself or other individuals. So we'll look at that more next time. But chapter 15, verses 1 through